measures that we were taking, but we would have taken them anyway, and we felt we were moving in the right direction.
You say you characterize yourself and others as being naive and that idealistic would be another way to put it.
Idealistic, I suppose, would be a better term. Yeah.
One of the first things that fascinated me about you was your leadership of that GI revolt in Garland County in 46.
46, that's right.
And there were some other very similar things happening in the South almost simultaneously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There was one in a rural county in Tennessee, around Athens, Tennessee, that turned into a gun battle, really.
I think it was a sheriff, wasn't
it? Yeah, and guys ended up surrounding the jail. They had hand grenades and automatic weapons, they brought them out like prisoners.
Right. You know, of course, this was right after the war.
Right.
And servicemen coming back were rather displaced, you know. They didn't have any deep roots, and they were in a transition. And so they were willing to take on these hot spots.
Yeah.
In Garland County, of course, the McLaughlin machine had been entrenched throughout the 19th century anyway. And he had inherited it and strengthened it, and of course it was based upon illegal gambling.
Right.
And of course the gambling as such didn't bother me, but all the things that it led to in order to operate an illegal gambling establishment was what led to so many of the evils. Since it's being illegal, they had to control the law enforcement officers, they had to control the sheriff's office, the district court, the mayor's office, the marshal, and they even controlled the jury system. Leo was a lawyer, and of course he practiced law, and they would select the juries from employees of the gambling establishment, the bookies and Belvedere and the Sullen Club and these other casino places. And unless you had the administration with you in a case, you couldn't win it. And in order to protect their empire, they resorted to almost any type of coercion it's imaginable, and even shooting people. I remember the last man, the man that really impressed me and made me aware of the situation in Garland County. I was in high school, I guess I was a senior in high school, and I was going with a girl named Evelyn Smith, and her uncle on her father's side, Brad Smith, ran for sheriff against the gang, and of course he was defeated, and then they assassinated him, killed him. And another man ran for mayor against McLaughlin, and they bought up the mortgage on his home and foreclosed on it. And of course, they even got into the school system, see, and the employment of teachers. And so it was a bad situation that I had an ambition to try to correct. And then when we came back from the war, of course, we had been through some battles, you know, and so forth. And so it wasn't intimidating to us. And,
you knew how to play rough.
Knew how to play rough, too, so we organized. And on election day, in the primary of July, August of 1946, we had a platoon of people in a central area at the Ricks Automobile Agency ready to move anywhere that they needed to move.
Just like a platoon in the military.
That's exactly right. That's
armed
exactly
and ready
right.
to move out.
That's exactly right. And the second ward was one of the wards that they used for transients, repeaters, and so forth. And they would vote those people several times, and whether or not they were qualified to vote or residents or anything. And then they'd move them around to other polling areas. But the second ward was the worst. And we put the word out that the FBI agents were in there checking on the election. And Hoover really gave us some backhanded support because he couldn't get directly involved in anything, but he let us, he gave us some information and so forth, the agents did. Mm-hmm. And so we set up cameras at the second ward and started taking pictures of these people coming through, and they dispersed. Mm-hmm. And so it cut down tremendously on that vote in that mm-hmm. ward. However, all of our candidates were defeated in that first primary. But I was elected because we had another county mm-hmm. in the district that was over in Mount Ida and Montgomery County. And I carried Montgomery County handsomely. And we had the telephone lines cut so that the people who were supporting them in Montgomery County couldn't call in and tell them what the account was so that they would know how many votes in Garland County to get in addition in order to win the election. Mm-hmm. And that kind of saved the situation for us. And of course, when the votes were published by the newspaper people got it. And then we knew exactly how many votes we'd gotten in Montgomery County. And I was nominated. And of course, then we had the general election coming up. And the poll tax was the worst thing in the world for fair elections. It was just used by these machine counties in order to perpetuate themselves in office. You know, of course, the poll tax originally was enacted, as you know, to keep the blacks from voting, but then it kept a lot of white people from voting. And not only did you have to pay the poll tax, but you had to get your poll tax a year before. In order to have voted in the August primary of 1946, they would have had to gotten a poll tax in November, by November the 1st, the preceding year.
Had to have paid their poll tax.
Paid their poll tax, see, and of course you can't generate much interest except mm-hmm. through the professionals.
Yeah.
Politicians know about that and go out and buy them up, and then, of course, in Garland County, they bought up blocks of poll taxes.
Sure.
They just went down the telephone book and had them issued, you know. And they held those in reserve, and of course added judges and clerks, people who worked in the gambling establishment. When the poll closed, they could count out whatever votes they needed in order to win the election.
It's amazing, considering all that, that you guys were able to...
Well, I tell you how we did it. We got it, we had Bob's name of... what was his name? He was from Fort Smith, and we got him to run as a write-in candidate for Congress. The time had passed to file, and I'll think of his name. But he was a write-in candidate for Congress, and so that created a federal question. And so we bought suit in the United States District Court to avoid the poll taxes, which they had purchased illegally, which they had obtained illegally. And they had a very complicated formula that they used. And it took us a long time to break that formula, as a matter of fact. Well, my wife did it. She's a good bridge player.
Now, you're referring now to the
November election.
The November election,
yeah.
Where all of the
Everybody
defeated candidates ran as independents.
They all ran as an independent, and I support them. And we launched a poll tax drive. Get people registered because we could register them up to a week or two before the election, see? And so we got, and the people began to see that, well, maybe we could win this, or maybe we could defeat this organization, see? My election gave us one law enforcement officer, you know,
yeah.
So that was tantamount to election in the primary, nomination in the primary. And so we went to work, and then we avoided those illegal poll taxes. And of course, that way we were able to elect all the GI candidates in
well,
the
now,
election.
Well, now, if you had not
Pat Mullis was the lawyer in Fort Smith.
Who ran for Congress?
Who ran for Congress as a write-in candidate and gave us a federal issue.
Did he win?
No. We didn't even expect him to win.
Yeah, it was just for the purpose of getting into
federal court. And Judge John Miller was the federal judge who decided that case.
And also, if you, if the GI faction had not bolted the Democratic Party and run as independents, you couldn't have done that either.
I couldn't have done it. See, we had the Democratic primary was over.
Right.
And in order to have a shot, they had to run as independents.
Right.
And then you could file as an independent 20 days before the election. See? So they all, they all ran as independents, and fortunately were elected.
Yeah. Now that propelled you into the state picture.
That's right.
The visibility that you gained from that, and in 48 you ran for governor.
For governor.
And got elected in a runoff primary.
That's right.
Against a man who raised a race issue.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, we had several opponents, and one of them was Jack Holt. And one was Uncle Mac McCrell, and I forget who the other several others.
But it was Holt who made the
Holt
runoff.
Holt made the runoff, and I got into the runoff by 12,000 votes. And McCrell was nominated, was eliminated, but McCrell had a very strong following. He was a radio preacher. He had a little orphanage, and he would go out and give out flour and things, and he had a strong following among rural people. And in the last days of that election, which was in August, they raised the race issue. And they told the people I was going to hire black policemen and so forth and so forth. And it was catching fire.
Yeah.
And catching fire. As a matter of fact, our lead was cut down because of that.
Well, if you put that in the context of what was going on, that was Dixiecrat summer.
Oh, sure.
I mean, even the governor of Arkansas at that time, Ben Laney, had effectively left the Democratic Party to help run a campaign for Thurman.
They walked out of the convention with Strom Thurmond and Fielding Wright. Strom Thurmond was running for president and Fielding Wright for vice president on a Dixiecrat ticket.
Which was a racist thing.
That's clear and simple. And they were against Truman because his attitude towards race and fair employment and these other things that finally became a matter of course later on is social legislation. And of course Ben Laney joined him as he was governor. And of course, when the primary was over, the gubernatorial primary, that was tantamount to election in August 1946. Well, I started campaigning for Truman, and he carried Arkansas by a large plurality. As a matter of fact, I think he got a better percentage vote than I know that any state in the South, because I don't think he carried any states, maybe Arkansas and Texas. I'm not sure he carried Texas.
I don't believe he did.
He did. But anyway, he carried Arkansas by a large plurality vote, and he never forgot it. And Truman came back to Arkansas. He came to Arkansas three times during his presidency. And he was very helpful to us in our water development program and extending our rural electrification program and so forth. And I got to know him quite well. And he was a great president.
Right, he was. What concessions did you feel you had to make in that primary campaign to this notion that
I didn't make any concessions. I didn't even deal with the issue.
Well, I mean, like on the question of the Truman civil rights.
I see. Well, I supported them. I didn't make any concessions. I supported them. I was for. Of course, one thing that I was for was this Tidelands Oil thing was an issue.
Yeah.
See? And the Texas and wanted the Tidelands Oil, and California wanted the Tidelands Oil, and so forth. And I took the position that Truman had taken, that the Tidelands Oil belonged to the federal government and should go for a national educational program, instead of given to the states. That was one thing. But of course, on the civil rights issue and the fair employment and so forth, I supported the Truman
civil rights program.
And of course, I was also, I opposed the poll tax. I tried to abolish the poll tax, which was one of his plans.
And a federal anti-lynching law?
Yeah, and I introduced an anti-lynching law. And of course, in the state Democratic Convention in November of 1946, we changed the rules so that the blacks could be members of the Democratic Party. Hmm. You know, the Democratic Party was an all-white party,
right?
See? And of course that is a tantamount to disenfranchise the black people.
Right.
And because at that time you had no Republican Party, no viable Republican Party, and a Democratic nomination was tantamount to election.
Sure.
So they really didn't have anybody to vote for. See, so we took them into the Democratic Party. And of course we got money to build the Amen in College at Pine Bluff and get it accredited. And we had a black student go to med school and a black student go to into the law school.
That actually happened before you became graduate,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah, the girl,
yeah,
that entered the med school,
med school,
I think in 1948.
I think, or 47,
yeah,
maybe.
Right, maybe it was 47, yeah. And then we tried to get more money allocated to the black schools.
Mm-hmm.
But my big fight was the power company.
Mm-hmm.
The power company was my big fight. One of the first things that I wanted to do, well, I wanted to build roads, which we had to have a road,
yeah,
had a road program. We had a bond issue, and we sold those bonds for less than 3%, 4.7%, 2.7%.
Mm.
We sold them at 2.7% interest. And of course, I was for building the medical center, which I built. But the rural electrification program was very close to my heart, because I had lived in the country,
right,
and without electricity, and I knew what it would mean to the farmers. So we were very strong for a rural electrification program. And because of my relationship with Truman, we were able to get Secretary of Interior Wickard loan the co-op's money to build the Ozark generating plant at Ozark. And of course the power companies opposed it. They were opposed to the rural electrification program. They didn't want to go out into this area because at the time it was not profitable, but they thought someday it would be. So they opposed it. And they were against the whole water development program because of the public power issue. They faced unfair competition and so on. And so I had a running battle with Ham Moses over the power company all the time I was doing my administration. When I was nominated in August, July, and we were doing a runoff between me and Jack Ogle, Ham Moses came to see me at the Lafayette Hotel, and we had a visit, about 30 minutes, and he got ready to leave. He made a remark that didn't register on me at the time, and he was trying to decide which one of us to support. The power company was very powerful politically at that time. He said, well, it doesn't make any difference which one of you is elected, because you ain't going to get anything done anyway. We have a constitutional amendment passed in 1933 called the Future Amendment, which requires a 3/4 vote to increase any tax other than a sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that the power company had about all the members of the Senate who were lawyers on their payroll. See? And every governor has had to fight that. When a special interest, you know, hiring these legislators and senators, and that has made it difficult to get a progressive program through the legislature. See?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we got the loan for the Ozark steam generating plant, and the Public Service Commission granted it, but the power company got it reversed, and that was delayed. And I think maybe under Faubus' administration, the Ozark generating plant was completed. And of course, Orville Faubus came to work for me. First as administrative assistant to talk to road delegations, people coming down to build roads, to get roads. And we had about 12 counties in the northern part of the state that didn't have a single hard surface road. And of course, he was from that part of the state. He knew these people, knew their language, how to talk to them, and so on. So So his first initial job was to visit with these people on this road project. And when Bob Faubus was elected governor, we had a falling out when he called out the troops.
Right.
To prevent the children from going to Central High School.
Right. But here you were in 1950, the most liberal governor in the South.
Yeah, that's right.
Aside from Ellis Arnold before you and Jim Folsom before you, who had taken somewhat similar position, but I dare say that neither one of them went as far toward a progressive reform in the South as you went in that period of time.
Right.
And you were reelected in 50.
That's right, against Ben Laney.
Yeah, which, I mean that, you could hardly imagine a more clear-cut ideological matchup than
right.
you and Ben Laney
right.
in 1950.
That's right.
And that wasn't a very good year for liberals either.
No,
you know, that was
plus
the year that
Truman was at his lowest popularity.
Right.
Of course, he came down, we dedicated the dam, the Bull Shoals Dam, and he endorsed me.
Yeah.
And of course, his popularity at that time was about 30%.
Way down. So. That was the year that Claude Pepper lost,
right.
and Frank Graham
right.
got defeated for right. election in North Carolina.
Right.
It was
right.
not a good year for the
no,
South,
right.
for people who had any notion of bringing about progressive
that's
change.
Right.
How do you figure that you were able to maintain that image in Arkansas at that time and still win against that tide? What kind of racial issues got brought into that 50 campaign?
Well, there was really no racial issues, I recall, in that 50 campaign.
Hmm.
Laney
didn't throw that at you?
No, he didn't. They accused me of being liberal.
Yeah, sure.
And being a Truman liberal, see. But they didn't, at least publicly, say anything about me being an integrationist.
I'm surprised they didn't do
that.
Yeah,
I am too.
Yeah.
I am too.
Yeah. How much did you beat him by?
Oh, it was tremendous.
I mean, it was decisive. Yeah.
Decisive.
Then in 52 you ran.
I ran for a third term in 52 and was defeated.
And you lost by a fairly sizable margin.
Yeah, I was in the runoff with Francis Cherry. I was in the runoff about 10,000 votes above him. And then in the runoff, he defeated me about 2-1.
Yeah.
Nearly 2-1.
Did race have anything to do with that?
No, that was a highway audit.
Yeah.
See, the Senator when he got old, the memory fades.
You got into a squabble, I know, over highway.
Yeah, highway audit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, they passed a highway audit bill, and it was sponsored by Senator Ellis Fagan, who was in the electrical business, and he did all his business with the power company.
Yeah.
And the chairman, they named the people who would serve on the audit committee, five of them. And the chairman was a member of the board of directors of the Arkansas Power Light Company. And so they conducted that investigation, and then in the spring, before the election, they started publicizing it. And they presented their findings to three different grand juries. The first grand jury did not return any indictments. And incidentally, they had at least two members of the Power and Light Company on each grand jury, or people who were partners to Ham Moses on the grand jury. And I've got all that documented. And the second grand jury, they hired a private lawyer to come in and act as prosecuting attorney, and they paid him from funds raised by members of the board of directors of Arkansas Farm Light Company. And when the judge found out about that, he dismissed the grand jury. Another grand jury was convened, and they returned two indictments. No highway employee was indicted, but they returned two indictments. And one indictment was dismissed for lack of evidence. The second indictment was a swinging board verdict. The jury was not 5 minutes brought in the verdict for the defendant. So that was a highway audit. But that was that's what defeated me.
Mm-hmm.
They defeated me with a highway audit, the accusations of fraud and corruption and so forth.
Let me ask you about some people. Again, coming back to the whole issue of race as a factor in all of this. I have a hard time understanding why the Ben Laneys of Arkansas didn't jump all over you with both feet after your victory in 48 and 50, and Truman's support and your support.
Well, they tried me in with Truman and said I was a ultra liberal and I supported all that Truman. Civil rights measures and so forth, but I can't recall of them ever calling me an integrationist.
Would it possibly be because at that time the notion that any real substantive change along racial lines was going to come to the South still just hadn't sunk into most people?
I don't think it had sunk in. They never realized that. And it didn't sink in really until the Central High School incident.
Even Brown didn't make it sink in.
No, he didn't. You know, Blossom Henry, or Henry, yeah, Blossom, Virgil Blossom,
Virgil
Blossom,
mm-hmm.
had this plan which he had taken to all the civic clubs and the labor organizations. Various groups in Little Rock and had their approval. It was an integration. But people were willing to accept it, you know, people are law-abiding. They were willing to accept it as law of the land. They didn't like it. And of course, they would welcome an alternative, and Faubus gave it to them.
Yeah.
See, the Virgil Blossom plan, if Faubus had stayed out of it, it would have gone in and worked. We never would have had all that.
Well, I guess in a way, to prove that what you're saying is correct, whoever had the idea to integrate the University of Arkansas by letting somebody into the medical school and the law school.
I think that happened under Laney.
It was during his administration.
Yeah, right.
And that seems to me is proof positive that people are essentially law-abiding.
Sure,
and if
sure,
somebody
right.
has an idea in a way
right,
and they
right,
say, now
good.
We're going to do
sure,
this.
Sure. Sure.
It people
right.
will do it.
And of course, the youngster that went to the law school, and I'm sure you know who it was.
Jack Shropshire.
Yeah, he went to the law school, and when he first went there, they put up a barrier around his seat so he'd be
right.
segregated, you
right.
know, for a while. And Judge Leflis came, Bob Leflis' class, and he finally took it down.
Yeah.
You know.
And those people went great. Through school, they got their
sure.
degrees, they
sure.
went out, I mean,
right.
and there was no hue and cry, and that was 10 years before. James Meredith going in the University of Mississippi, the
right.
state next door here, and two or three people were killed, and
that's
he had to call out the
exactly right.
marshals to get him in there.
That's exactly right.
So people are law-abiding.
Right.
They will do if they have leadership.
That's exactly right. It wouldn't have, if it had proper leadership at that time, the Central High School thing never would have happened.
Well, the period 45 to 48 kind of looks to me, looking back on it, as a sort of a window of opportunity.
It was.
45 to 50.
Yeah, 45.
You know, when with the right kind of leadership, the South could have done some amazing
sure,
things.
Sure.
But it just couldn't.
Well, the Dixiecrat thing set everybody back.
Yeah.
You know,
the politicians, by and large, failed us.
That's right. Exactly right. You know, the politicians, they play the. They all a nigger, you know. They play
right.
and get the rednecks vote,
right.
and they get the money from the special interests.
Right.
They get elected from by the rednecks because they all a nigger, and but then they serve the interests of the corporations.
Right. And then institutions fail too. The church
right.
failed. You know,
right.
you look for moral leadership in this period mm-hmm. when the crunch was on.
Right.
The church was not able to deliver it.
That's right.
And ultimately, the universities turned out to be not really instrumental in preventing a long period of turmoil. And the press, too. I mean, you had the Arkansas Gazette taking a moderate position.
Right.
But at the same time, you had papers all over the Southeast, like in Jackson and Memphis and other places took the line of the power struggle.
Right. And of course, in Arkansas, the pillar of the power structure was the Arkansas Power Light Company.
That was it.
They're very conservative, and they were just treating Arkansas as a colony.
Yeah.
Mid-South was only.
Right. You think that most people by that 48-50 time knew in their gut that segregation was not going to last forever?
Well, I don't think they, people generally didn't know that.
Couldn't assimilate.
They couldn't assimilate that, and, custom dies hard.
Yeah.
But there were people, intelligent people, and educated people, and people in positions of leadership that knew it was inevitable. The Brown decision, you know, and after that, you know, it's just a matter of time.
Right.
And then, of course, when you get that back down to it, what's America all about?
Yeah.
You know, what's about it? We hold these truths to be self-evident, you know, all men.
You can't have that kind of language written into your history and dodge that question.
And it's taken a long time to bring it about.
Yeah.
But look at the impact that concept, that philosophy has had on Western Europe.
Yeah.
You know, they all want that they inspired by the American Bill of Rights and the American Declaration of Independence.
Exactly.
So we have to make it work at home.
Yeah.
And of course, when after the war, of course, we were motivated by the fact that we've been fighting against this kind of thing that exists in, say, in Garland County and a lot of other places over the country. And if we're going to have it, if we fight for it in the world, we want to fight for it at home.
Right. Do you think that you yourself, as a politician and as a lawyer, saw the Brown decision coming before it got
here? Oh, sure. Absolutely. It's inevitable.
You knew that?
Sure, I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
I knew that we couldn't continue to keep the black people ignorant.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get... You can't keep them enslaved.
Yeah.
You know, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free the blacks. It freed them from slavery, but it placed them in servitude under this sharecropper system,
yeah.
See?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the Second World War that we escaped from that. And I guess it was the John Deere tractor and the cotton picking machine that did more to free the blacks than anybody. It wasn't in 1965, wasn't it? We abolished the poll tax.
Yeah, that's really true.
Huh?
That's right. That's how long it took.
Sure. And you talk about individual rights and personal freedom and so forth, look at the women. Women didn't get the right to vote in 1920.
Yeah.
See? So, of course, I felt and I knew that it was inevitable, and I felt for these people.
Yeah.
Of course, I lived in South Arkansas, and I saw the plight that the black people were in, and I had a great deal of empathy for them as a child.
Mm-hmm. And yet, growing up as an adult, you know, the common thing that you heard white leadership say in the South were two things, separate but equal.
Yeah.
And they knew it wasn't equal.
Right.
And the other thing was, if everybody will leave us alone, we'll work this out ourselves.
Yeah, don't want any outside interference. Outsiders coming here telling us what to do.
Can you imagine that the South would ever have worked it out by itself?
Not today.
If there hadn't been for Brown and the courts and the black revolt.
Oh, in a century or two centuries.
Mm-hmm.
It might, the economic conditions change and people get educated and so forth, and if the blacks are not equipped to earn a living and so forth, it might eventually come back, but it's taken a century or two centuries to do it.
Do you think the notion that...
Well, just like with the South have abolished slavery.
Yeah.
Maybe eventually, economically, maybe in 100 years it would have come about.
Yeah.
But, No, you had to have the Brown decision, and you have to have federal intervention, and it was federal intervention that abolished the poll tax.
Yeah.
And look at the child labor laws and the right of women to vote, and all this come through federal government.
And so to say that the 45 to 50 period was an opportunity for the South.
Great, tremendous opportunity. Gone either way.
And yet to imagine that it might have done it any other way is kind of hard to.
Oh, sure, that's right.
Because, as you say, without the leadership, without the federal intervention, without the pressures from outside,
you wouldn't have had it. Wouldn't have gotten it.
It's hard to imagine.
You needed leadership, and you need the pressure, and you had to have public leaders who are willing to take chances, willing to expend their credit to accomplish something. If you're elected, what are you supposed to do with your power and your influence? You're supposed to accomplish something, see? And if you know something that's right, this is what you should do, is what's good for the country and so forth, you shouldn't have to take a poll to determine whether or not it should be done. One thing about Harry Truman, he never had to take a poll to decide what was right for this country.
Right.
Like he went into Greece and he went to the Berlin Airlift and the Korean War and dropping the bomb and firing MacArthur. He didn't take a poll.
Later on, you ran again for governor.
Ran for governor against Faubus.
And then you also ran for the Senate.
I ran for the Senate in 1954. I lost the Senate in 1952.
Right.
When they beat me, I lost the Senate in 1950 when I ran for third term. I ran for third term in 1950.
Right. No, in 52.
52. Yeah.
And
in 54,
then
I ran for the Senate.
Ran for the Senate.
In 52, of course, they got my opposition, and when I say I was naive, I took on all the power interests at one time, the oil companies, the power companies, and the special interest insurance companies and so forth at one time. And I should have done it individually, but I combined to get me. Well, they had Francis Cherry from Jonesboro, they had Jack Holt again from Harrison, they had a lawyer from South Arkansas who was Attorney General, you know his name, and then they had Boyd Tackett, a congressman from Western Arkansas, Ike Murray,
mm-hmm.
And then they had somebody else. And so when I was eliminated, I mean when I did not win in the preferential primary, between me and Cherry in the runoff, they all gathered at Jonesboro and endorsed Cherry,
mm-hmm.
all of them. And they were all being financed by the power company. All being financed by the power company.
So you lost an election in 52 and one in 54,
that's right.
One in 62.
And 62 is when I ran against Faubus.
Did any of those have hang on the race issue?
Oh, well, hell, the 62 did. I mean, the Faubus against Faubus were all races.
Did the 54 one when you ran for
president? No, the race issue was an undercurrent.
It really wasn't till Little Rock, till Central High, that race became the burning issue in Arkansas.
McCarthyism was an issue in the Senate race. Of course, I was opposed to McCarthy and his tactics and so forth. And Senator McClellan, although he was on that committee, we had some divisive issues, and of course McClellan was against Truman's program, see, and I really got a foul with McClellan during the Truman administration,
mm-hmm.
and of course he knew I was going to run against him for the Senate, and of course Laney ran against me in 1950 for my second term, and of course they were at that time trying to head me off.
Yeah, you know, right. McClellan and Fulbright both turned out to be fairly obstructionist on the whole racial thing.
Fulbright, bless his heart, although he's a great man and so forth, he never took a stand on the race issue. I mean, he went along with his
verbiage. He really did.
He never
signed all
did anything.
The manifestos and all the rest.
That's right, and he was an educated man.
Yeah, that's
Strode scholar.
Pretty disappointing for a man.
Never raised his voice on behalf of the oppressed.
That's not a happy legacy for a man of his stature.
He had the Fulbright scholarship is his legacy, but as far as the blacks concerned, he never turned a hand.
Yeah.
As far as the laboring people are concerned. Of course, you know, the laboring issue was a big issue.
Yeah.
See, I was for the unions.
Yeah.
And at that time, we were trying to get workman's compensation increased. We were trying to get the minimum wage increased and so forth and so forth. And and McClellan and I were just like that, as far as all the labor unions.
Right.
See?
Yeah.
And of course, the labor unions have fallen into disrepute now, but they served a great purpose.
They really did.
They served a great
purpose. Yeah, I shudder to think what would have happened without them
through that period of time. Yeah. That was a big issue in the city.
Can you think of anybody, white or black, in the South in this period from 45 to 54, who just comes to your mind now as being honest and forthright and outspoken and correct on the racial issue in that period, not later, not after Brown, but before?
Well, you mentioned the governor of Georgia.
Yeah, Ellis Arnold.
Ellis Arnold was out front.
Yeah.
He was a great man.
Yeah.
Ellis Arnold. I'll tell you somebody else. Earl Long.
Really?
Earl Long.
Yeah.
With all the troubles he had and so forth, he was right on the race issue.
Mm-hmm. Jim Folsom was right.
Jim Folsom.
It's kind of hard to think of others.
I was trying to think about somebody in Texas, but Shivers and...
Maury Maverick.
Yeah. Maverick. Maverick was right.
Yeah.
Maverick. Jim Trimble, Arkansas. Jim Trimble was he was right on the race.
Was he a congressman?
Congressman, yeah. He did more for the development of the water resources.
Mm-hmm. Where was he from?
He's from Variable, Arkansas. He was a judge, circuit judge, before he ran for Congress.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else come to your mind?
Clyde Ellis,
another congressman.
Yeah, he was a congressman and. He became head of the rural electrification program.
Mm-hmm. Harry Ashmore.
Oh, Harry Ashmore, by all means, sure. Johnny Papa.
Yeah.
Johnny Papa.
Yeah.
Check this. They were around.
Just one more thing or two, and I'll be on my way. Daisy Bates was a person who later on in Little Rock became a sort of a leader of the black protest against Faubus. Did you ever know her during this early
time? I never worked with her.
Uh-huh.
Never worked. Of course, I knew her by Auburn, so I never worked with Daisy Bates.
Anybody black in Arkansas or elsewhere in the South?
Harold Sherman was a black Methodist preacher.
Where was he from?
In Arkansas. I think he was from Little Rock.
From Little Rock.
Of course, Henry Woods.
Yeah.
Now United States District Judge.
Yeah.
Ed Dunaway.
Mm-hmm.
Who was a judge and who was a prosecuting attorney. You know Ed? Have you talked to Ed Dunaway?
No, I don't.
Edwin Dunaway.
Mm-hmm. Any journalists that you got to know other than Ashmore and Popham? What about Ralph McGill or Harding Carter?
Ralph McGill and Harding Carter were outstanding. They were greatest.
Yeah.
Of course, old Mr. High School, you know.
Yeah.
High School, you know. And then Pat Patterson, you
mm-hmm.
know. Patterson succeeded. I guess he was publisher, wasn't he?
Right. Well, that pretty much covers the ground that I wanted to get go over with you. I, I can't tell you how much I appreciate
this. John, it's good to
really
talk to you.